Hello and welcome to Root Causes, the PKI and security podcast where a pair of industry veterans talk about PKI certificates, trust models, encryption, and matters like that. This is episode 16. I am Tim Callen, senior fellow at Sectigo, and I am joined as always by my co-host, Jason Sirocco, CTO of IoT at Sectigo. Welcome, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Tim.
So today we're talking about DevOps.
Yeah, DevOps, hot topic at the moment. When I'm speaking to people about the topic of DevOps, especially from a security standpoint, which is where I'm usually coming from, but when I talk about DevOps and some of the underlying technologies that are commonly used, I'm finding that there's a lot of information that and maybe the storyline of how we got here might have got lost somewhere.
So it's interesting, right? DevOps isn't really a technology. DevOps is a method, right? A practice.
It's a set of principles, just the terminology, those two words that are kind of slammed together, DevOps. It really is all about better collaboration between developers and the operations team that usually has to deal with the software that is the output of those developers.
Right. And about agility. And it's ultimately interwoven in a bunch of computing platform technologies that are transforming or have already transformed the modern IT infrastructure. But trust and security has to be approached a different way, right? Once you're using these DevOps principles, right?
Certainly. There definitely are a number of technologies. I think in this podcast, we're going to be talking about one of them. So but even before we get there, Let's go back to that goal for a second between the developers and the operations teams. Probably one of the main goals here with DevOps is really, really trying to create a really fast and stable workflow between the two groups. Because right now, there's a lot of silo between the two. And the way that things had been traditionally done, you know, with waterfall methods of software development and old ways of doing things that maybe kind of work fine in the old, you know, monolithic coding days. Today, with some of the burgeoning technologies such as cloud, how do you get your applications up to the cloud quicker, less bugs? How do you get a faster rate of actually going from the point of conceiving something to... Right. And getting it out there and live and then being able to rapidly iterate it and change it, the people who run operations and the people who run development, they're going to need to hold hands a lot tighter. And I think there's maybe four principles to get through this idea. And one of the main ones here is this idea of everything as code. Probably one of the biggest problems with the amount of collaboration between developers and operations is just the sheer amount of manual work that had to happen. In other words, ask yourself the simple question. If I gave you, you know, an operations person who is monitoring a cloud service that you just built and a developer who's maybe building patches, what's the chances on any given Monday morning that those two people will have identically the same system if they both worked manually to build the Linux distribution and all the dependencies and all the things that make up a computing system to make it go? The chances are pretty slim, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, you know, even back in the traditional days, how many times have you ever heard, you know, the developer give the excuse to the operations guy, well, this thing works on my computer.
Right. Yeah. More times than I can count. That's why we have QA, right? Every developer always confirms that it runs and it always runs on their system, but clearly that isn't the whole universe.
If you think about where we've gone from various other kinds of technologies, such as virtualization, which was a way of basically bringing together whatever application you were running within a specific operating system and then having a lot of control over it, that's great. But that may have been fine in a more monolithic way of thinking. It still works today for a lot of functions. But for the most part, a lot of code now is being written in discrete bits. And those discrete bits don't need the entire weight of an entire operating system. So there's lighter weight forms of that. We'll get into that technology in a moment. That's containerization. And we're going to talk about the security of containerization a little bit later in the podcast. But let's talk about this whole idea of DevOps again, and maybe four ideas behind this everything as code, a really important concept within DevOps. Remember when the scenario I gave you where you have two different people both trying to build their own infrastructure to be able to match each other. The chances that every single configuration within those things is going to be identical is pretty slim.
Right.
Therefore, the entire infrastructure should be codified in some sort of declarative specification. This means that standing up infrastructure really shouldn't be done by hand. It should be codified for consistency into a type of template that can be repeated often. There's lots and lots of tools for that now. You've probably heard of Chef and Puppet.
Yeah.
And they all have their strengths. They all have their reasons for why you'd use one or the other. But this idea of codifying things to stand up, especially cloud infrastructure, because you're constantly going to be bringing up a cloud infrastructure, you're constantly going to be bringing it down, and you want the ability for those things to happen very, very consistently and have the results be the same all the time.
And so not to dumb it down too far, but what you're saying is you want your code to be consistently running in the same environment every time.
You at least want to get to the point where your code is actually running on the exact same platform. For those of you who come from pure Microsoft stack world, Windows itself has all kinds of dependencies as part of its platform. And that's Windows is great for that. It's why stuff is still built on Windows Server to this day and probably will for many years to come. The thing with the cloud, though, is you now have all kinds of different Linux distributions. And the definition of a distribution is that every single Linux distribution is bundled with a different set of code, a different set of dependencies, a different stack of this and that,
yeah,
all the way from the GUI on down to some of the nuts and bolts. So in terms of this everything as code idea, keep in mind that not only do you want to have this declarative specification for how to very easily have a consistent platform all the time, but you also want to, as always, have your source code that's basically controlled in something like Git, so that, you know, it's for the same reasons you might have done before the DevOps days. You also want to do your code that's tested in some sort of a quality assurance program, some sort of a pipeline process to make sure that it passes muster. But there's another probably newer idea, and we're going to call that immutability.
Okay.
So in other words, Tim, remember when I said your infrastructure, perhaps in the past you set up a Windows server and that thing probably stayed up for a very long time and you just made changes to it kind of by hand. You might have had development pass over patches to the operations team, and the operations team might have applied those patches as time went on, but the server never really changed. I think the idea of immutability, there's probably several ways to define it, but I really like the idea that infrastructure should be considered disposable.
Right. Okay.
What you gain by that is that it avoids the infrastructure being patched to some level that's inconsistent with another. In other words, your Q&A systems, your developer systems, your the systems that might be used as some sort of a test server by operations, they should all be pretty much identical. And also, all of them should be considered disposable. You should never just have one server that lives forever. And it's kind of the de facto standard, the gold standard that everybody needs to sort of have to figure out how to match. Everything's immutable.
This is a decoupling, a detachment of the actual hardware from the software processes, from the work streams.
100%. So in other words, the developer no longer has to do an enormous amount of thinking.
Right.
In fact, they're discouraged from doing a lot of thinking about the server, right?
Yeah. I need to know a few things. I need to know how much compute I have and how much memory is available and how much storage is available. And other than that, I don't need to worry about any of that other stuff.
Yeah, you got it.
Right.
So let's talk about one of the underlying technologies that's really helping out, and it's having a real renaissance right now because of how important it is. We talked about virtualization a little earlier, and obviously that was a way of, you know, taking monolithic pieces of software and running them in isolated virtual machines. And that was fantastic. It still works to this day. People use it all the time. All kinds of usages for it. But what happens if you no longer have a problem standing up all kinds of small servers in your cloud environment, for example, or even in your own private rack space, doesn't matter. One of the things that you now still have the problem of, though, is you have all these different distributions of Linux out there.
Yes.
And you don't want your code to be distributed in such a way where you're going to have to worry, but the operations people have to worry about the dependencies.
Yeah.
The software obviously has its dependencies, and the servers have all kinds of different starting points. You want to be able, from just about any starting point, to get up and running and have that discrete bit of logic just do its thing. And this is where the concept of containerization comes from.
Right.
Now, most people think that containerization is a form of virtualizing. I think that's where a lot of people get into trouble because it's not a VM. A container is really about bundling a discrete piece of logic. It's code, essentially.
Yeah.
Along with its dependencies. That's probably one of the most important concepts you can understand if you really want to understand containerization. The question then becomes, well, why do I need it? We already have virtualization. Virtualization is isolating an entire operating system, each instance hosted with a hypervisor. Hosters are actually run within a container engine. Hosting engines, you know, you might have heard of Kubernetes, which is actually, I think, is derived from the Greek word for orchestration, which we'll get into in a moment. But keep in mind that containers are much more lightweight than VMs and much less isolated from the underlying operating system. So that's, if you want to understand containers from the highest level, they're really, really lightweight ways of just bundling together code along with its dependencies. And containers really should not be thought about like a VM because of the less amount of isolation you have from the underlying operating system.
Okay. And are you going to get into the significance of this less isolation as we move forward? That seems like a pretty important point.
It's probably the most important point from the standpoint of security, right?
Yeah.
Because of the fact that when you're running things within a VM, a virtual machine, you can definitely count on the hypervisor itself providing some level of isolation in memory space between the virtualized operating system and the underlying operating system in kernel. Obviously, there's problems. Check out any of your favorite hacker conferences, and there will be examples of various hypervisors, you know, people finding holes within them. But suffice to say that jumping out of a hypervisor, you know, that's not something that the average script kiddie is going to do on a Saturday afternoon.
Right. Gotcha.
But the problem is, think about now all these different discrete pieces of code, which have their own interconnects, and they also have their own, they connect to a database. Yeah. They have their own user connections, human-based authentication.
Right.
They might also, one container might call another, not just within its own cloud, but to another cloud. The multi-cloud containers. These, anytime you're doing any kind of reach out and touching of anything, you're traversing network boundaries that are no longer as clear and secure as you might have remembered back in the old monolithic days.
Sure. And we might be talking about a lot of containers, right, Jay? I mean, if you break down your complicated enterprise work streams into these little discrete bits, and each of these discrete bits is running as its own container, you can have a very large number of these, and you can have a very complex and dynamic environment that you're dealing with, right?
Well, for those of you who come from a certain, you know, day and age, when you remembered writing a discrete function, you know, a subroutine that did one specific task, that one specific task might be containerized today, and therefore right. completely isolated out of a code stream into its own cloud-hosted container. And right. the cloud worries about, you know, balancing the compute time and the database power and everything else that might need to be going on behind that to make sure performance is at the right level. But to your point, yes, you know, a single piece of software, if you want to call it that, a whole solution might be calling all kinds of containers, might be using other people's containers, might be...
Yeah.
It just goes on and on. In fact, this is the worst kind of spaghetti logic potential that perhaps we've ever had. Maybe other people could argue otherwise. But I think that, though, Tim, the reason why we don't have to worry too much about it being spaghetti code is the amount of benefit that we're getting from isolating discrete bits of code and hosting it on the cloud. This new way of thinking, and especially with the DevOps cultures now that we're starting to see being developed, it's all a very, very big net positive. The one big potential net negative is the orchestration engines that are actually helping to curtail the spaghetti potential and do things really well, like handle networking definitions and all the things that are necessary to make sure that lots and lots of containers work together well. They actually, one of the things that they're actually running are certificate authorities because of the fact of the, that there's such a big need for TLS certificates for things such as mutual TLS authenticated sessions to other APIs or discrete pieces of logic. You might even need, if your application happens to be a web application, where is your SSL certificate actually being provisioned within that logic when this immutable disposable infrastructure is brought up and brought down? That's a lot of certs all of a sudden. And if you think back in the old days of, geez, I just need one SSL cert and it's going to sit there for you know, a year or 2 years. This particular application goes off and makes an API call to something. I've got a TLS certificate that I provisioned a long time ago. I've got it written down in a spreadsheet. So when that thing expires, I'll just go handle it. Multiply that, Tim, by, I don't know, pick a large number in your mind. Yeah. All of a sudden, it is unmanageable. And some of these certificate authorities we're talking about, I think the majority of them are self-signed CAs that are just sitting there in not terribly well-protected premises, if you just want to call it that. Geez. As a PKI guy, I just shake my head now going, I love this technology. It is the future. But when it comes down to, you know, just purely the TLS cert management part of it, I don't think this has been completely fully thought out yet.
And Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, but the certificate element of this architecture is indispensable because it is how identity is provided, and it is how you make sure that before your software takes action, that it's getting its command from the legitimate source of that command, or before your software reports information, it's reporting it to the legitimate recipient, right? Like the only way this is done is certs, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So you are running it. So if you are using a popular containerization environment, you're using Docker, you're using Kubernetes, you are running a CA, whether or not you know it. Correct?
With Kubernetes, absolutely. Yeah. You are.
Okay. With Kubernetes. So what are the potential consequences of people who all of a sudden have become their own certificate authority, maybe without intending to?
You know, if I'm a CIO or if I'm a CISO and I'm hearing this for the first time, I might be asking my DevOps team these questions. Because Tim, you know, one of our favorite themes across all these podcasts we do is what happens when certificate management goes bad?
Oh yeah.
Things go out. And one question we haven't even asked too much yet, because we think the answer is perhaps too obvious, but what happens if a CA gets compromised?
Yeah.
What happens, you know, dot, dot, dot. And the answer to all these questions is very, very bad things.
Right. Well, potentially, I mean, once your identity system is not reliable, then any entity anywhere in your work stream might be a bad actor.
Correct.
Might be spying, might be stealing data, might be giving false commands. All of those things are possible. Could be stealing your money or just disrupting your operations or stealing credentials or other things like that.
So Tim, let's think about this now. Let's widen out the problem just slightly.
Okay.
And for those of you who might want to, or you're being asked by your management, hey, we're really glad that you created this proof of concept inside of one cloud, such as maybe Amazon AWS, mm-hmm. You could answer the question, hey, you know, I do my TLS management right within that cloud. Though, but that's great. It's still self-signed certificate. It still has its issues, but at least you have some kind of a management system that's helping you out that perhaps is part of the infrastructure that you happen to be using with that one cloud. What happens though if your CIO tomorrow says, you know, AWS is too expensive today. I want to rip it out and put it onto some other cloud tomorrow. Right. And then next week, I want to bring it in-house. Oh, and by the way, the week after that.
And not all of it. I'm just going to do some of it and I'm going to leave some of it where it is.
Yeah. And in fact, your CIO is going to say things like, hey, you told me this thing was immutable.
Right.
And so why can't I do that? And then you're going to, you know, you're going to give the old answer of humana humana.
Right.
And go, yeah, that's all great, sir. But the problem is, or madam, the problem is that our entire security infrastructure is baked into one particular cloud. And don't think Amazon or the others haven't thought of that, right?
Right. Yes. So what do you do?
There's such a thing as a trusted third party CA. And one of the reasons why you come to a trusted third-party CA is so that your trust model is basically maneuverable, and interoperability is going to be the norm. So in other words, instead of just setting up some self-signed certificate authority through just a series of a few Linux commands and then hoping for the, you know, crossing your fingers that, hey, I didn't see any error messages, it must be good.
Right.
You might want to think about setting up a CA with people who actually understand how to run a proper CA and know how to protect it, know how to make it reliable, and all those things that, well, frankly, you don't have if you just do it by yourself.
Right. And this is why we have specialization, right? This is the reason that we're all not growing green in our backyard, is because it makes more sense to have somebody else do that, and we can all focus in on things that we're good at. I think this is a perfect example of that.
It gives you that ability to say, hey, I have a well-protected CA. I can rely on it. This is run by the people who know how to do it properly. But I think you can even go further than that. There's some value add by choosing commercial third-party CA for your DevOps and containerization purposes. And that's the fact that we can also wrap in capabilities such as code signing your container. Mm. So in other words, if something gets modified between the developer release and the actual code being executed, you can rest assured that you actually have the integrity of your own code. And that kind of thing can be actually put into your logic. Today's third-party Vault tools that might act like a CA don't really have that kind of capability. The ability to have a single root for all your applications, the ability for the root and subordinate private keys to be protected in HSM, that ability to have multiple Kubernetes clusters that are actually, you know, rooted in a single place, or whatever other trust model you happen to need. Those are the kinds of things that you need to go to a trusted third-party CA. You're not going to be able to do that yourself. And typically the people writing tools like the Vault tools that you've all read about, that's not what they're experts in doing. They're just there what most Vault tools are really trying to do is to do things such as, hey, you've got static credentials for your MySQL database in behind the scenes, or your Mongo database, whatever it happens to be. I need to automatically log into those systems from a headless, you know, discrete logic system. I know I'm not going to log into that myself. So I need to pull it from somewhere, and I need to pull it from somewhere securely. Well, those Vault systems do that very, very well. But as soon as you get into the world of PKI, the complexity of the trust model, the complexity of rotating those certificates. Mm. And Tim, here's another concept. Your OCSP responders, once you start having large, complex enterprise level applications that are within, you know, containerized systems, are you going to do revocation checks on the certificates that you've actually issued? Well, you know,
right.
A modern trusted third party CA will also be able to set up OCSP responders for you. Then you have that kind of capability. Those are powerful PKI tools that you're just not going to have if you're setting up your own, your self-signed certificate authority.
Right. And if these are your most essential mission critical systems, if these are the places that you move your secrets around, that you control your money, that you service your customers, IT departments are asking themselves, how can I be secure at that level?
And if you're running any other kind of key material, SSH keys, if you're doing, obviously, if you're provisioning SSL certificates for web applications that you happen to be running, we could, you know, a trusted third-party CA can also handle those things for you all at the same time, as well as your code signing, as well as setting up your CA properly, protecting it properly, all those kinds of things. So for those of you who are working furiously right now with these fantastic new technologies in DevOps, you know, you might want to think about not just doing the, you know, proof of concept example of firing up a little CA and hoping for the best and crossing your fingers. People who've been in the PKI business a long time can really start helping you out here.
That's I think maybe that's a good point to end on, Jay. As always, this is a complex topic, and there's more, and I'm sure we'll get into more depth in episodes to come, but maybe this is a good point to thank our listeners for your time today, and thank you, Jay. I'm glad we covered this topic. It's also something that we touch on a lot but never really explained, and it's good to do that.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's a great subject, and hope to hear more from our audience about this as well.
All right. Thanks, everybody.